For the week of November 29th, 2009, this is Showbiz Sandbox, Episode 31, the podcast that brings you all the dirt on the news making headlines around the entertainment world. In Los Angeles, I'm Jay Sperling Reich.
And in Los Angeles, I'm Karen Woodward.
And in New York, I'm Michael Giltz.
Michael, how come you know we're cool? How come you're not sitting at the top of, you know, Statue of Liberty or something?
Nothing was happening this week. Still in the kitchen raiding the freezer for leftover Thanksgiving food. I'm Michael Giltz.
Yes, here in the United States, for those of you who are listening from abroad, it was what?
Or in space.
Thanksgiving. We celebrated our Thanksgiving holiday. And quite frankly, I'm still feeling a little bit sluggish from it. Kind of like the week in entertainment news. There wasn't a lot going on necessarily.
Except the biggest Thanksgiving box office ever.
Okay. Yes, that's true. And I guess that was also your way of moving us right into the box office news for the week.
10-minute long podcast.
That's right. For the second week in a row, the biggest news at the box office was Sandra Bullock's film The Blind Side, which increased dramatically from the week before, as often happens for movies released the week before Thanksgiving. It grossed $40 million, increased by 17%. It was a huge success. It's already grossed $100 million. Sandra Bullock is the biggest female box office star in the world right now. And it almost beat out The Twilight Saga New Moon because that film suffered a dramatic drop, as one would expect. The Twilight Saga grossed $42 million over the three-day weekend. But, you know, let's not get caught up in those drops. It grossed $230 million in the U.S. alone. So Twilight Saga was number one barely with $42 million. Blind Side was number two with $40 million. 2012 is still chugging along. It grossed $18 million, and it's at $138 million total. Old Dogs was the weakest new entry, I think, as far as movies we expected some action. It was pretty tepid, $16 million beginning, $24 million total for the five-day holiday week. A Christmas Carol bumped up a big amount. It grossed another $16 million. It's got another 2 weeks to go before Avatar knocks it out of the way off all the 3D screens. It's over $100 million. Ninja Assassin, a terrible movie that wastes a really good title, that grossed $13 million. Planet 51 grossed $10 million. Precious grossed $7 million, which again would be a great total for this film. But it is starting to drop pretty significantly. It had a 34% drop. Its total gross is $32 million. The Fantastic Mr. Fox grossed $7 million. That's a pretty weak wide opening for that movie. That's at a total of $10 million. The Men Who Stare at Goats, which Overture picked up for $5 million, grossed another $1.5 million. It's at $30 million total. The Road, an Oscar hopeful, had a modest opening, $1.5 million, and that's about it. The Boondock Saints, which was a massive hit, the first Boondocks movie on video, on DVD, grossed $1.2 million. And that's it.
And that's the Boondock Saints 2.
That's right. It's a sequel to a movie that became a massive hit on DVD and brought about the release of a new movie, despite the first film's, you know, agita over the way the movie was made. But I know that Karen has finally seen The Twilight Saga New Moon, and I want to know what you thought.
First of all, I want to give a quick plug to the documentary Overnight, which documents the making of Boondock Saints 1, which is absolutely unmissable. If you have not seen it, you should Netflix it.
Well, and actually, that's why, not to interrupt you, but that is why I left that there. It's the number 12 movie this week. But a week or two ago, Troy Duffy, who was kind of thrust into the spotlight back in 1999, or was it 98? It was somewhere in that time period when he was picked by Harvey Weinstein to direct his own screenplay, and Harvey Weinstein bought him a bar. He appeared on The Business with Kim Masters.
I heard that.
And he seemed like just as much of a jerk today.
I know.
As he, and I mean, that movie Overnight, which was directed by one of my former classmates from NYU Film School, he was one of Troy Duffy's producers. And so he was filming the making of Boondock Saints, and what it turned into was this kind of tell-all documentary called Overnight, in which this guy loses his mind. This filmmaker kind of lost it. And then you listen to him today, and he sounds no better. He says, oh, I'm not the same Troy Duffy as I was 10 years ago. Sure sounds like it.
But he also said that those guys, you know, we trusted them, and they totally turned it around. And it's like, I don't know. There was no editing going on here. I mean, you couldn't tell. They just started, and they just sat there in a room and let Troy Duffy bury himself.
Right. And part of it, I mean, the filmmakers are in the film and they're being kind of shellacked by this guy.
So we agree that the documentary about the movie is much better than the films itself?
Yeah, I would say the documentary is much better than the film.
Oh, yeah.
And I wonder if a documentary about the making of the Twilight saga would be better.
Yes, let's
film.
Talk about the fact that Karen finally saw Twilight. I thought this movie was objectively awful, but I was entertained. I was entertained. But I could not help but notice what you had mentioned last week, that there are like moments where they deliberately like pause so that you can ooh and ah over Taylor Lautner's abs. And like when she, you know, spoiler alert, but when she hurts herself and he like whips off his shirt to like wipe away the blood, my audience laughed.
My audience did as well. Yeah.
I think it's a little bit better marginally than the first one. I think it's slightly zippier, but it's still not by any stretch a good movie.
Well, you know, last week when you were talking about Blindside being the big new box office news of the week, when Twilight New Moon was setting certain box office records, I thought you were kind of joking around and I thought it was kind of funny. And ironically, it was true last week and it's definitely true this week. I mean, the film, that film almost beat out Twilight Saga New Moon. And when they screened it at Show East, I kind of made fun of a few exhibitors who told me that they were really looking forward to seeing this film. And I expected people to come out of that screening and say, oh, you know, it was okay. It was what you had expected, predictable. But everybody came out raving about it. So this film has really got a lot of positive word of mouth.
Yeah, no, it's definitely a family film. It's what it is. I saw it this weekend. It's actually not as bad as the trailer made it out to be. It's not quite the broad Sandra Bullock, wacky, rich, white female woman helps little black kid, I should say.
Big black boy.
It's actually a little bit subtler than that for a fair amount. It gets a little boring when they get back really heavy into the football. But it's not a good movie. But it's not that bad, and she's pretty good, and it's a fairly subtle performance, especially the way it looked in the trailer. So it's not that bad, and I can understand why audiences are watching it. You know, it's an audience crowd pleaser, inspirational tale.
Well, certainly over this past Thanksgiving weekend, at least in North America, people were going to see the movies. In the U.S. and Canada, $275 million set a record for the Thanksgiving holiday weekend, a record which stood since 2000. So, and this past weekend beat out the 2000 record by 12%.
What was released in 2000? Sorry to put you on the spot.
Yeah, thanks, by the way. I appreciate that. I've got no idea.
Okay, you go look that up.
Now, I don't want to go. I have a couple things to say about the box office this week. One is about Precious. There's no way to paint this as anything other than a huge success. It dropped 34% this week. Who cares? It made $7 million, which is a ton of money. It's at $32 million. Is there a feeling, though, perhaps that maybe they are gonna peak early? You know, as far as Oscars and that whole thing, I feel like...
They've been peaking, you know, all year. What are you talking about?
Don't get me wrong. If Precious doesn't make another penny at the box office, it's a great success story. But as far as trying to position yourself for the Oscars, I think maybe they are going to be running out of steam, you know, by mid, late December, and then come January, you know, once it's dropped out of the top 10, maybe it'll feel a little bit old news.
I agree.
Yeah, I totally agree. They should have released this movie now, or December, even better.
December 25th.
Maybe a little earlier than that.
By the way, Karen, what was released on November 17th, 2000, was How the Grinch Stole Christmas and Rugrats in Paris were the two big moneymakers.
Animated films?
Well, How the Grinch Stole Christmas was Jim Carrey. Also, 102 Dalmatians and Quills and Unbreakable were all released that week.
Remember when people actually went to go see Jim Carrey movies? God bless him.
Now, Sperling, people got all, oh, look at Twilight Saga, it dropped 70%. That really doesn't matter anymore, right? When a movie can make $72 million in one day, and frankly, within the next 5 years, some movie is going to make $100 million in one day, dropping the second, who cares, whatever, as long as the big box office total of $230 million is impressive. These week-to-week drops don't matter much anymore when you can make $140 million in one weekend, do they? You've got to always keep it in context.
Well, it all depends on the film. And in the case of Twilight, and specifically Twilight New Moon, that film cost $50 million to make. So making $72 million in one day, of which Summit will probably see close to $40 million of that, yeah, that's actually pretty good. That's actually precisely what you want to have happen with a film like that. That is a big bang movie. It goes out and they're expecting to make 50, 60, 70% of their money right there in that first weekend. They did.
Mm-hmm.
And of course, worldwide, it's a huge phenomenon and is making a ton of money, as is The Princess and the Frog, which Disney opened on two screens, one here in Los Angeles and one, Michael, in New York. And this is an astronomical figure. It made $1.142 million on two screens for a $356,000 per screen average. That's unbelievable. That's massive.
That's unbelievable.
And that is an animated film, Karen. So
I'm silently crying
that.
Over here. No, I totally, I understand.
You know,
I think it's amazing, but I understand. If I had kids, I would take them to go see this movie.
You know, another film that pretty much should be considered animated was 2012, which came in third place this week with another $18 million. But that film is doing extraordinarily well overseas. It has earned $455.8 million overseas, bringing its worldwide total to $594.6 million. So if you are ever wondering why it is Hollywood keeps giving Roland Emmerich money to make these huge disaster films that are panned by critics, that's why.
Yeah, it's a little underperforming in the U.S., I think, but it doesn't matter. He makes, just like the Caveman movie, he just makes so much money overseas that it's a success story. But I have to say, Sperling, remember we were talking before about, you were saying, oh, year to year, ticket sales down or this, that, blah, blah. I mean, and you made a good point about how the population is so much bigger that maybe compared to the 80s, we should be selling more tickets. But given all the competing things for movies, we're looking at maybe an annual box office of $10 billion for the first time ever. And then when you look at ticket sales for the noughts, they're going to be above what they were in the 90s, and the 90s are above the 80s. So the Hollywood, you know, industry loves to cry wolf about, oh, declining DVD sales, et cetera. But movies are a huge industry, making a ton of money at the box office, selling more tickets exponentially over previous decades, and also DVD and video on demand and all that. It's still a great business, and they're making a ton of money.
Yes, but it really, I think they like to say they're not, so that way when they charge more at the box office, there's a reason for it.
Well, there's still one movie, you know, with all these movies coming out, I still have friends who are excited about some of the movies that are due. And coming up next week, I believe, in New York City is the George Clooney film that I was really high on in Toronto called Up in the Air.
I am so excited to see this movie.
And I can tell you, Karen, you will not be disappointed. Don't go in expecting don't go in expecting the greatest thing since Gone with the Wind, but it is a really good film and well worth seeing.
But you put a link in the show notes about the marketing challenge that Paramount had.
Well, yeah, the LA Times has a story by Claudia Eller, I believe, about how Jason Reitman wrote this film 6 years ago during a different economic climate. The times were booming and everybody had a job. And so doing a comedy about corporate downsizing, you know, it didn't seem like it would touch a nerve. And of course, now we have the greatest recession in the last 70 years. And George Clooney, as you mentioned, Michael, stars as a beguiling hatchet man named Ryan Bingham. He is a rootless soul more interested in racking up frequent flyer miles than in engaging emotionally with the people around him. Although,
by the way, isn't that the biggest douchebag name ever? Ryan Bingham?
Eller points out that Bingham's personal soul searching is the center of the film's narrative, and certainly that is what drives the narrative, but that the sting of these job losses that you see happening are very much in the foreground of the film, and you see them happening, I would say, throughout the film.
But I think this is a bizarre article. This is what makes the movie so timely. This is, they compare it to a Mighty Heart in these grim movies like Mighty Heart and United 93, which is ridiculous. It's not even remotely like that. It happens to be about something that everybody can relate to, job insecurity and losing your job.
Yeah, especially now. This seems very timely.
It's not depressing. It's great. And when you watch the people and how he works with them and talks to them, it's really gripping. It's some of the best part of the movie. This is what makes the movie zeitgeisty and absolutely perfect for the moment. And it's what's going to, and it's not solely about firing people from the jobs. It's really about his emotional relationships and all that. So there's this whole romantic comedy stuff going on, and there's a lot of light, funny stuff. So this is not a grim film. It's nothing like an Iraq War movie or United 93. It is a romantic comedy. It's got substance. It's got a heart. I would be thrilled that the movie is coming out right now if I was Paramount. If they think they've got a problem, they're crazy.
Well, it has a $25 million production budget and a $40 million marketing budget. That's how much Paramount is going to spend marketing the film. And they said that because of its intangible subject matter, they decided to do a one-minute TV spot during the Thanksgiving weekend to outline the story, which is, of course, twice the length of the typical television commercial, and they, I guess, aired it during some football games.
Why is this exactly an intangible plot?
No, it's not. I don't know what they're talking about.
I don't understand that.
And a one-minute TV, it's not. It's about a guy who's always on business trips and has no personal life, who meets the woman of his dreams. Oh, that's so intangible.
I know. Whoa, high concept.
What am I going to do? Plus, a one-minute ad is not unusual, and it's not twice the typical length of commercials. Lots of commercials are a minute long. Avatar was, what, 90 seconds long, 2.5 minutes long? They had those ads all over the place. It's stupid. It's a stupid comment. It's a dumb story, making it sound like it's this grim, horrible. No movie that's grim and horrible is ever an easy sell. But this movie is not that.
Here, I can solve your marketing challenge. George Clooney. Okay, done.
Well, and I can tell you that it's probably one of his best roles ever.
Oh, yeah.
And I wouldn't be shocked if he were nominated for an Academy Award at the end of the year.
Yeah, I wouldn't either.
Oh, no, of course he'll absolutely be, I would imagine. I mean, you know, he's certainly on the short list.
Yes.
But, you know, I am embarrassed to say that I've seen the trailer for Avatar a number of times, and there's a scene in the trailer, I don't know if you've watched it enough, Karen, but the girl, whatever the characters are called, I don't know what they're called, the aliens.
The Na'vi.
The Na'vi, right, on Pandora, and she says, you should not be here. And she does this little hand gesture with her hand, you should not be here, and her hand opens up in like a spread, like she's pushing him away. And I actually, I've seen it so many times, I practiced it, so I could say, you should not be here. She has a fist that comes up and then be here, and her hand opens up into a palm, and I actually practiced it because I thought it was so funny. So I'm learning
I wish we had video right now. Damn, no, I have not noticed this.
If you watch the trailer, any of the trailers, you'll laugh when you see her do it now. Because picture me going, you should not be here. which brings up the next story.
Well, yeah. And I should say the next stories, because if you didn't want to hear about Avatar, then you should maybe visit Antarctica for the next month and a half. Because there are so many news stories about Avatar now that it's supposed to be released December 18th. And so there's a huge run-up and a big media push that 20th Century Fox, the studio releasing the film, is undergoing. There's so many news stories that the Los Angeles Times actually had an Avatar News weekend roundup. And it looks like they're going to continue to do this on the Hero Complex blog. So Jeff Boucher is helping out there.
Mm-hmm.
And this morning in the Los Angeles Times, there was a story about a USC professor, Paul R. Frommer, who is a linguistics specialist who was brought in by James Cameron, the writer-director of Avatar, to create an entire functioning language for the tribe of 10-foot-tall blue aliens who inhabit Pandora, the setting for the film's conflict, although apparently in the trailer they speak English and raise their fists in a very funny way.
You can't be here!
You should not be here.
Damn, I sound like Schwarzenegger when I try it.
But how very appropriate, given that it's a James Cameron film.
Well, this guy's story strikes me as a bit like J.R.R. Tolkien and The Lord of the Rings. Tolkien was a linguist, and he actually created the Elvish language, and then he began to write poems and little stories so he could use the language. The language came first. That's what interested him. And then he started to write Elvish poetry and a few other things, and then that led into The Hobbit and The Lord of the Rings. So the language came first for him. In this case, you had the movie, and they needed a realistic language to drop in there. But this poor guy is all alone, unable to talk to anyone in this language.
That's right.
How bizarre is this, right? I mean, this guy must be a complete nut job, right?
Well, I actually thought the same thing, because Jeff Boucher wrote this piece for the LA Times, and it says that Frommer spent 4 years creating this language for the Na'vi tribe, and his work will not end when the film is released, because he plans to keep inventing words for this language for any potential sequels and online dictionaries, and he's really hoping that it becomes like Klingon,
People won't have to be a professor anymore?
Well, I don't know. But, you know, in Star Trek, there's the Klingon language. And he says here, "I'm still working, and I hope that the language will have a life of its own. For one thing, I'm hoping there will be prequels and sequels to the film, which means more language will be needed. I spent 3 weeks
in..." More money for me. Sorry.
And you'll love this, Karen. "He spent 3 weeks in May, as he says, working on the video game for Ubisoft, which is the name of a French company. That's not a French word, though. I don't know where they got Ubisoft."
It's the toilet.
Well, it's, you know, it's not that strange, I don't think. I mean, if you're a linguist, what could be more exciting and challenging and interesting than creating a language out of whole cloth?
Right, and he actually created the syntax and all of the rules. He created a whole structure and grammar.
Yeah.
Yeah, he, of course, the actors weren't too happy because apparently it's a bit of a tricky dialect. And he actually, Frommer complained that, quote, "The constraint, of course, is that the language I created had to be spoken by humans. Darn those human actors. I could have let my imagination run wild and come up with all sorts of weird sounds, but I was limited by what a human actor could actually do." Too bad.
Okay, I have to admit, though, that the dork in me kind of is fascinated by this, wondering what this guy is like to hang out with.
Well, he does say, and this is really where I went, this guy might be, you know, he might have one or two screws loose, who knows. Boucher ends his piece writing that Frommer finds himself walking the campus sidewalks and talking to himself in the language. He has attempted to write poetry, too. It wouldn't be surprising if some of his couplets were forlorn. "It's lonely being the only person speaking a language. I just wish," he said, "that I had someone to talk to."
Aww.
Well, I think the LA Times is going a little overboard on their coverage of Avatar. It's not surprising that there'd be a ton of coverage because it's the first movie from the guy who did Titanic, the biggest hit of all time by some standards. But I have to admit, I was fascinated by the Wall Street Journal article that we linked to about how the fact they're not done with the special effects. This movie's been in the works for so long, I'm a little surprised.
This is such a Cameron moment, though. I mean, Cameron is always like this, tinkering right up into the last minute. Although, this may be pushing it. Of course, Titanic was pushed from a summer July 4th release
to Christmas.
And that was a big deal. And now, John Landau, who is James Cameron's longtime producing partner, he said that crews were working at 24/8, that is 8 days a week, that's to finish some of the special effects and some of the work to complete the film. He said that around 30 minutes of the movie remain incomplete, with issues ranging from sound mixing to more serious aspects like visual effects. The total running time is likely to fall somewhere between 2.5 hours and 2 hours 40 minutes, which does not include the credits.
Which is another 12 minutes easy.
Right, and there's always, you know, stuff that's being done and work that's being done right up to the point of release, and that is usually color timing and sound mixes, but in this case, it's really pushing it on a film this big.
I think this is just Cameron being a perfectionist.
And that's exactly what John Landau said, that as more shots come in from Weta Digital, which is the special effects house that's doing this, of course that's Peter Jackson's special effects company, which did Lord of the Rings, that his standards are rising with each and every shot.
I'm sure that's all this is.
You know, one thing about the marketing of this movie that surprises me, I saw The Blind Side and they had a trailer for Avatar, and it was the same darn trailer, that same long 2.5 minute trailer trying to explain the whole darn thing. I was expecting the romantic aspect trailer. I'm surprised they haven't started pushing that, especially for something like The Blind Side.
Yeah,
There should have been a romantic stirring trailer. You know, they didn't show it. They showed the standard trailer.
Yeah, but it's basically between two Smurfs, right? I mean, what woman really wants to see that?
But romance is romance.
You know, whether it's two bucks
or Robot and Wally or whatever it may be, you got to show the romance. You know, if you're going to sell it to women, you got to play up the romance a little bit. And this was the same typical
thing. Women don't want to see two CGI characters hooking up. It's just we want ours to be, you know, vampires and humans.
Or werewolves in the case of Taylor Lautner.
I mean, you've got to have a female trailer. You have to have marketing geared towards women, and I'm not seeing it yet. And that's a surprise.
Oh, maybe it's because James Cameron hates women.
You should love them. They gave him his biggest hit of all time.
That's true. And it turns out some sources are saying that all of these late-minute changes and late-minute additions to the film and all this last-minute work is actually causing the budget, which is nearing $300 million, to increase. But James Cameron is arguing now that the cost of developing the technology for Avatar shouldn't belong to the film's own budget. It should actually be spread across any movies that are made with the technology in the future as well, which I guess is kind of true, but let's face
it. Not really.
Right now, they built it for Avatar.
Yeah, I mean, if you couldn't make your movie without doing something, then sorry, that's part of your movie's budget. That's like if you invent color for your movie and say, well, but other people will use it. It's like, well, tough. If you wanted to be the first to do it, then you spent the money and that's part of your budget.
Well, and Anne Thompson is saying that Cameron's Avatar may debut at Harry Knowles' Butt-numathon. And of course, Harry Knowles is the editor of Ain't It Cool News. He's, you know, editor and founder of that website. And he is friends with a lot of high-profile filmmakers, including Peter Jackson, who showed him an early cut and the latest print of The Lovely Bones, which he reviewed on Ain't It Cool News recently, mm-hmm. long before many critics were allowed to review it. And according to Anne Thompson, James Cameron, who often calls Knowles when he wants to promote something, is trying to override 20th Century Fox and have the film debut and premiere at the Austin-based Webmasters 24-hour film marathon.
And that's a week before the movie opens.
Yeah, December 12th and 13th. Yeah. So that means that James Cameron will have one less week to tinker.
It's a smart move. Harry Knowles is one of the more respected of the, I guess you'd call him a blogger at one point, and he was just a blogger. But yeah. If you get a good review from him, you're pretty much set if you're a dork.
Well, wait a second. I wouldn't say he's the most respected, one of the most respected bloggers.
Well, he's a sellout.
She says of the online, you know, geek community.
Yeah, I mean, pretty much people believe that he's been bought out by the studios and he kind of is just, you know, their mouthpiece at this point. Certainly he is well-read in terms of having a huge audience. So in that regard, yes.
Well, respected by geeks, maybe not by media critics.
That's true.
Yeah, he's got his fan base. He's got his audience. People who care about these movies go to Ain't It Cool News. I go there if I want to read something about The Hobbit because he's going to have it.
Yeah, or anything like a comic book movie or anything having to do with like that might interest a teenage boy. That's where I head.
Are you trying to pick up teenage boys?
I smell a cougar. You know, and speaking of
I prefer mine 25. Thanks.
as we switch over to television, I have to say I've been watching Cougar Town and it's sort of growing on me a little bit. The Courtney Cox.
How good is that?
Yeah, I liked it. The Thanksgiving show was funny. It's sort of like a classic TV sitcom, except the mom finds out something about her son and embarrasses him in front of his girlfriend. And in the old days, it would have been like, I think I'm going to kiss her. And of course, today it's like, oh, he thinks he's going to have sex with her tomorrow. And
yeah, that's she comes the thing in with like that condom.
Right, exactly. A condom. So it's funny where television has taken us.
Well, one place it's taking us is to our DVRs.
Mm-hmm.
And I guess, Karen, you highlighted the story Jay Leno loses audience to DVR machines. And
by the way, can we just chuckle for a second that the headline was DVR machines? What?
Yeah,
you mean VCR to DVRs? DVRs?
it was an AP story. And they say that everybody was worried that NBC would lose audience members in the 10 o'clock hour to some of its competitors, but in fact, they're not losing audience members to competitors, but rather to DVRs. And
DVR machines.
DVR machines, yes. And I'm quoting here from the AP story, NBC's audience at that hour is down sharply, as many predicted. CBS is up 6% over last season, primarily because it moved the hit series The Mentalist into that time slot. On three of the five nights, its audience is down. ABC is also down slightly at that hour, and it wasn't exactly overwhelmed with the hits last year either. And this goes to exactly what I was saying in an earlier episode, I can't recall which episode, that the 10 o'clock hour is that hour when we all catch up on what we put on our DVRs or DVR machines between 8 and 10 o'clock. So, you know, we get home, we cook dinner, we eat dinner, we put the kids to bed, and by 9:30 or 9 o'clock, we're in front of the television watching what we missed at 8 o'clock, and by 10 o'clock, we've caught up to where we are or should be at 9:30. So we never actually watched the 10 o'clock hour.
Yeah.
Well, I watch the 10 o'clock hour. I watch the 11 o'clock hour. I watch 12:30. I watch everything. I just don't watch it on the time when it airs.
Yeah,
grant you, I'm not watching the 10 p.m. show as it airs at 10, but I certainly watch with my DVR. I don't care when a show is on. I watch Craig Ferguson more than I ever would because of the DVR. I watch stuff on at 2 in the morning. I watch stuff at 4 in the afternoon. I just watch it whenever I want. So the DVR doesn't keep
Michael,
me from watching.
Do you sleep?
I don't sleep. It doesn't keep me from watching 10 o'clock shows. It just keeps me from watching shows when they want me to watch them. But this is pretty funny. Not only are people not watching Jay, they're not even turning on to the competition. They're just turning on their DVR. There was a Hollywood Reporter story today saying, oh, Jay Leno's ratings have leveled off. It was trying to be a positive spin story. But it's like, I'm sorry, they couldn't fall much further. So they're at the 4 and 3 level. So, you know,
yeah,
the
no
Jay Leno.
There's no positive spin to Jay.
Well,
yes.
NBC lost an average of 1.8 household rating points at the 10 o'clock hour compared to the fall of 2008. And according to the Nielsen company, at the same time, DVR usage went up by 1.4 points in that hour. So they really only lost 0.4 when you think about it.
Yeah. And there's a quote from Mark Berman, which I disagree with a little bit. He says, Mark Berman of Media Week said, they gambled. This was the biggest risk I've ever seen a network take in television history. They gambled and they lost. And it was a big gamble, but I don't know if it's the biggest risk ever. I mean, they stripped Who Wants to Be a Millionaire. They had Dateline NBC on 4 nights a week. They had Peyton Place on 5 nights a week. You know, this has happened before.
Yeah. I still think it was a risk.
Yeah. Do you think it was the biggest gamble in TV history?
No. No, I agree with you there.
Well, I guess we'd have to say what was then, but I don't know.
Well, NBC said that they need Leno to achieve a 1.5 audience rating among its target audience of 18 to 49-year-olds to make the network profitable during that time slot. And during Leno's first 40 shows, the ratings dipped below that number 10 different times and equaled it 5 times. I would assume that he bettered it the rest of the times. Is that what they're saying? Since it dipped
below 10
times. That's
a good point. I guess modestly bettered it, yeah.
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 I have to say, I've dipped into the show a little bit again. It's still pretty much nothing. I never liked Jay Leno anyway, but I have to say Conan has finally stabilized and is sort of finding his footing at the 11:30 hour.
Good for him.
Do either of you watch Flash Forward? I know you started to at the beginning of the season. Have you continued to watch it?
I stopped. I got bored, although I hear it got better.
It did get better. I'm one episode behind. I think I'm only one episode behind, but I'm kind of, you know, engaged in it. And
have you found out anything about the kangaroo yet?
Not a darn thing about that kangaroo. I have no idea why the kangaroo has appeared in 2 episodes. Uncredited, I might add. But there was a story where was it? Entertainment Weekly. Flash Forward shuts down production, which, you know, had all this exclamation points in the story that they exclusively told Entertainment Weekly that ABC...
No, Oziello, Michael Oziello, Oziello Files.
I have no idea who that is.
Oh my God, I followed this guy since he's been at TV Guide. And I was at the upfronts once. Oh, Michael, you will appreciate this. I was at the upfronts once for CW. And I saw him and I went up to him and I talked to him. And I was like a bumbling fan. I was so embarrassed. I just couldn't believe it. It was Michael Oziello.
Well, I guess that goes to the fact that I don't watch a lot of television. Except for Flash Forward, of course.
Right.
But ABC temporarily shut down the production of the new drama. And that move comes a month after the departure of one of the show's co-showrunners, Mark Guggenheim, and less than a week after Flash Forward hit a new ratings low. Now, ABC spokespeople or spokespersons or spokesfolks, I don't know what you want to call them.
Spokesfolks.
They said, look, this is just a creative break that the show started shooting early, and they did it with the intent of taking a break because, quote, they want to maintain the high quality of the show, and this gives the writers the opportunity to do so. So they're saying, look, this is just a mental vacation.
Well, but I mean, they said it was already scheduled break. And I mean, if they were shutting the show down, really, I mean, there's no advantage to shutting the show down for a week. So I assume it was a built-in break, like ABC says. I don't understand why it's a story. Because
yeah, I agree.
Either you stop filming production, in which case it's a story. But like, they, you know, especially dramas hour-long, sometimes we'll take a week off or, you know, they'll have stuff built in or for the holidays or to catch up or whatever. So I don't think this is a story unless he proves that it wasn't actually scheduled.
It was a story? Because Michael Oziello or whatever his name is got exclusive information. And so he wanted to share it on EW.
But But didn't he also, who broke the story about Courtney Cox shutting down production of Cougar Town because she had personal family issues? That interests me far more than
Yeah, that is a story. Yeah, that was a story. Whatever her, you know, God willing, everything's fine, whatever, who knows. But yeah, that actually is a story where this just seems like, oh, they're taking a scheduled break.
Big deal. I agree. But well, no, Sperling, I think you're absolutely right. I think it was a slow news week, and Michael Oziello happened to talk to somebody at Flash Forward who said, hey, we're shutting down production. You're shutting down production? I don't have a story this week. I'm sure that's what happened.
It's a bad story that blows it up into something that's not.
Well, I'm sure the Thanksgiving week causing a shortage of entertainment news stories was not necessarily kind to Adam Lambert, who was, I guess, you know, he was the main headline grabber this week after his performance, his sexually filled performance at the American Music Awards. He was cut from Good Morning America, an early morning talk show on ABC.
And picked up immediately by CBS.
Yes.
I find this story fascinating. And I think that Adam Lambert is exactly right. I think that there is a double standard, or somebody even said a triple standard, because the women on the show, because I went back and I watched some of the performances. There were a lot of really suggestive performances by women, like Janet Jackson grabbing some guy's crotch. And Adam Lambert does what any woman would do, whether it was kiss a man or kiss another woman, but they like cut it, or, you know, they fog it out, or they get all up in arms about it. Such a double standard.
Well, on CBS, Adam Lambert said, just to play devil's advocate with you, Lady Gaga smashing whiskey bottles, Janet Jackson grabbed a male dancer's crotch, Eminem talked about how Slim Shady had 17 rapes under his belt. There was a lot of very adult material on the AMAs this year, and I know I wasn't the only one. I am not using that as an excuse, and I didn't take any offense with those performers' choices. I'm just saying I think it's up to a parent to watch the television. It was almost 11 o'clock at night. If they're concerned with certain material, maybe TiVo it and preview it before your small child watches it.
Yeah, put it on your DVR machine.
Yeah, he said, I'm not a babysitter. I'm a performer.
I totally agree. Michael, what do you think?
I agree, too. I don't think it's a controversy, except in the sense of The View and Good Morning America looking for something to talk about. I'm stunned that the GMA would have canceled his performance. I mean, unless they actually didn't know what he was going to do and feel annoyed that he sort of surprised them.
Well, he did. He did.
And he says that. He admits
said,
that.
Yeah.
And
yeah, but I don't buy him. I don't buy that. That's all. That looks so painfully rehearsed to my mind. The idea that he spontaneously pleased. That stuff is worked down to a ninth degree. They've got cameras. They've got pyrotechnic smoke.
I don't buy that he suddenly decided
to kiss the guy. They totally planned that, and of course they did. And in my mind, it was controversial because it was so lame, not because it was so shocking. So I think the next day, brouhaha is just, they're bored for news, you know.
But do you think that there's a double standard?
Sure, of course. Guys, people love to watch women kiss, and they freak out if men do. You know, it's getting better, but, you know, sure, it's okay.
That's the part of the story, I think, that really intrigues me the most. Like, I agree with him. He's not a babysitter. He's a performer. I agree with everything he said.
Yeah.
But the part that really sticks out to me is the fact that there is a double standard. And I think it sticks out to me because I just never thought about it.
Well, I think it's natural. You know, I mean, within the last 15, 20 years, you know, it was illegal in most states to be gay. You get arrested for having sex with another man. You lose your job, you lose your home, you lose your apartment. So there were very few depictions of gay people on TV. Today, they're omnipresent. They're, you know.
But the fact is, it's woman on woman, and that's okay.
Yes, because people don't find that threatening.
I find that fascinating. It's really fascinating.
That's a 1,000-year-old cultural tradition almost throughout the entire world, that they think the women are just making do until the man shows up, and so they don't find it threatening. They think you're just bored, you know, and they're titillated if they're not disinterested. But when men do it, then it's very threatening because it's gay.
Well, I can almost guarantee you that you won't see the person in our next story, who, by the way, is also a reality show star, or
of course
was born out of reality television.
On a talent show. Let's not say a reality show. Let's say a talent show. It's like being on Ed Sullivan. You know, being on American Idol or Ed Sullivan or that. It's not a reality show where you were locked in a house with people and then decided to launch a music career. They were people presented as artists singing or dancing or doing whatever.
Whatever you want to call it, I can almost guarantee you that you will never see Susan Boyle kissing a man or a woman on television. However, you will see her at the top of the record sales charts with the best sales week in 2009, beating out Eminem.
I love that. I love that Susan Boyle is even in a headline with Eminem. And you know what? I have to admit something. I would consider actually buying her album.
Oh, God.
Yes. It's like, it's background music. I sit around at home all day. It's background music. I can picture. I know. I'm embarrassed. Okay. I'm embarrassed. But I can picture myself doing it.
I dreamed a dream.
That still makes me cry.
For those who don't remember, Susan Boyle was the rags to riches story that started out on Britain's Got Talent, a talent show, as Michael points out, where she astonished the judges with her made-for-Broadway pipes despite her calling-all Kmart shoppers looks. She performed I Dreamed a Dream, as Michael just kind of demonstrated.
Sing.
And she became a worldwide YouTube sensation. 75 Absolutely. Million views, 80 million views, and now she released her debut CD, I Dreamed a Dream, also the name of the CD, and it will be the number one album of the week and the number one debut this year, or the number one, I guess, release this year.
The highest total for first week sales.
675,000 copies of the CD were sold, topping Eminem's Relapse, which sold around 605,000 units in its opening week. And according to the Daily Mail in the UK, Boyle's album is the quickest selling debut in history ever in England.
Well, a couple of things. First of all, it's fascinating to see. Usually someone like this, people don't flock to the stores first day because they're older buyers like Barbara Streisand, Susan Boyle. It takes a while for them to get into the store. So for this one to open first week, that's pretty amazing. But I saw it on sale at CVS Pharmacy and the sticker said, as seen on Britain's Got Talent and YouTube. And that has to be the first time someone said as seen on YouTube on the sale of an album or movie or something.
Yeah, usually
I thought that was
saying,
fascinating.
As taken down on YouTube.
But she's really not a good singer, unfortunately. And I have not listened to the album, but she wasn't good.
You don't think so, really?
Oh, no, not at all. She's good for a pub. She's good for a pub singing. Oh, my God, Aunt Susie's got a really good voice. She's fine, but she's not a talented singer in any on a real level. No. I mean, I wouldn't go see her for free if she was across the street, you know? Yeah,
wow.
No, she just, you know, God bless her. You know, she's got a better voice than most people, but she's not a good singer. All her other performances were pretty weak. And I Dreamed a Dream was a bit much, but it just shows how far the record industry has fallen that 675,000 copies is the number one album of the year. That's a telling sign of how far album sales have fallen.
We should say 675,000 copies
in the first week.
Yeah, in the U.S.
That's right.
On that note, we should move on to Big Deal or Big Whoop, our popular segment where we review all of the week's top entertainment news stories, or at least some of the week's entertainment news stories, and determine whether they are a big deal or whether anybody should care about them. We start out this week with Disney Channel naming a new president, Carolina Lightcap, who was the senior vice president of and chief creative officer of Disney Channels in Latin America, will now be taking over the role of president of Disney Channels worldwide. Of course, Rich Ross, who used to hold that role, is now the studio chairman, I believe, is his title. Big deal or big whoop?
Okay, I put this on the list, so obviously I thought there was something kind of interesting about it. Now I can't remember what it was.
Well, I think it's interesting that a woman was put in that position because, of course, you know, they say it's kind of a man's game. And in this case, it's a woman who was known for building the Disney Channel in Latin America into one of the top cable channels in that region.
Mamacita.
And the Disney Channel Entertainment president, Gary Marsh, will actually become the chief creative officer, I believe, is his role. And
yeah,
he will report
title.
To Lightcap. So, you know, she's got a pretty big job.
And there are people who argue that he should have gotten her job.
That's what I mean. That's why it's a big
deal.
Yeah,
that's probably. Yeah, it is. It is a big deal, I suppose.
Michael?
I'd say it's a big deal, not because it's a woman. I think you've got a fair number of female executives in TV and females running networks in the past. So I just think it's a big deal for Disney Channel. She's got a channel that's been chugging along and she's got to maintain it. So it's not the biggest challenge in the world, but, you know, it's never easy to keep those juggernauts rolling.
Yeah, and Gary Marsh was the person behind High School Musical and Hannah Montana. So that's why I think a lot of people felt he would get that job.
It'll be an even bigger deal when he quits because, you know, his consolation prize was, we'll give you a new title.
Moving on to our next story, Techniques will stop making turntables. As one of the first products that enabled consumers to listen to recordings at home, the turntable qualifies as one of the most important musical inventions of the 20th century, and Technics stands out as one of the most iconic and influential brands. However, the Australian arm of Panasonic, which currently owns and manufactures those turntables, will stop making the record players in February of 2010, citing steadily declining sales as the reason to halt production. Is this a big deal, Karen?
Oh, hang on, I have to wake up from my nap. Maybe, I don't know. I don't care enough. Michael?
I think that the story itself is a big deal in the sense of the ending days of a format. It's sort of, you know, plaintive and nice, but it's a complete big whoop as far as how they report it. They say, oh, there's video games that involve turntables. Yeah, DJ Hero, which was a flop. And then they moronically say, oh, vinyl sales are through the roof lately. No, they're not. The vinyl sales last year were $57 million in a $4 billion U.S. market for music. So no, vinyl sales have gone from zero to a tiny blip. And that's why turntables and LPs are and always will be forever a niche item for tiny little companies that want to appeal to, you know, audio enthusiasts or little geeks. I mean, people still make Victrolas, but that doesn't mean major manufacturers should. It's ridiculous. They were smart and right to stop it.
Moving on to Brad and Angie, because of course no podcast is ever complete without mentioning Brad Pitt or Angelina Jolie. Apparently, they spent more than $6.4 million on charity this past year. Their 2008 tax return shows that the Hollywood couple sent over $6 million to different charities, and they gave $13 million to the Jolie Pitt Foundation, and it was the Jolie Pitt Foundation that, I guess, gifted the $6 million to the charities. And that is more than double what they gave in 2007, according to their tax returns.
And these are all for United States companies? Or,
well, the biggest
Global Health would be international, right?
Well, yeah, the biggest recipients were Global Health at $2 million, Human Rights Watch at $1 million, Brad's Make It Right Foundation, $1
million. By the way, please tell me that it's actually called the Make It Right Foundation, not Brad's Make It Right Foundation.
Yeah, it's Make It Right Foundation. I believe that's the New Orleans efforts that he's, you know, to help rebuild New Orleans. Other notable contributions were $500,000 to the Armed Services YMCA of the U.S. Army, $50,000 to the Springfield, Missouri Public Schools, and if you're wondering why...
Oh, that's nice!
Well, that's Brad Pitt's hometown, so that's why he did that. And roughly $1 million to projects in Cambodia, the country from which both Brad Pitt and Angelina Jolie adopted their first child. Michael, is this a big deal or a big whoop?
It's a big whoop in the sense that people, of course, can and should donate to charity. They should. It would be a big deal if they didn't donate a couple $1 million a year to charity because they're worth hundreds of millions of dollars. So good for them.
Karen?
Yeah, I agree. As a news story, it's big whoop. But just in the sense of people who have the money donating it to charities, I always think that that's a big deal.
Well, since we have to read about them so much all the time, I'm just glad that they are putting their money where their mouth is. Our next story is about our good friend Roman Polanski, who has finally been granted bail by Swiss authorities. He will be paying $4.5 million, or I should say 4.5 million Swiss francs, which is the equivalent of 4.49 million US dollars, and will be in effect under house arrest until he is extradited to the United States, if he is ever extradited to the United States. He will have to wear an electronic ankle bracelet and will be confined to his chalet in the Swiss mountains.
Poor guy.
Is this a big deal or a big whoop, Karen?
I think this is a big deal. Sort of. I mean, part of me is like, I'm already bored with the story, but I think it's an interesting choice to have given this allowed bail to somebody who is sure to flee the country, but at the same time, he's probably not. So,
I think it's a big whoop news wise. You know, rich people get different treatment in jail. That's fine. I mean, he's given his age and the terms of the thing. It seems perfectly reasonable.
Right, and the only reason I think it's a big deal is they granted a guy bail who has once skipped out on bail. I mean, what were they thinking?
Yeah, no, that's the only big deal part of the story.
I think given that they took time and made it very strict and they're going to have the ankle brace, they didn't just say, okay, sure, we'll see you. You know, they made it pretty, I think it's unlikely that someone that, you know, will be able to get away with that again. They will be watching for him, you know. That takes us to our next story, which is television-based, and it's the reality show, reality talent contest, I should say, So You Think You Can Dance, which just announced their top 10. The show launched itself in the fall after being on the summer for a number of years, and it's been pretty weak in the ratings, and it's probably also a mistake to go up against, you know, Dancing with the Stars. They're both airing at the same time. But I think the dancers are really good, and I'm totally down with Jacob and Nathan. Is this a big deal or a big whoop, Karen?
I think this is sort of a big deal for the show because its ratings were down so much. And I noticed that you put in here, but quality F dancers. Is that a typo? Or are you saying that you're giving them grade F?
I'm saying the dance, the quality of the dancers is pretty good. And the show itself is still
fun. That's a typo.
Yeah, that's a typo.
To me, the biggest deal was that they, So You Think You Can Dance and Dancing with the Stars were up against one another. It just seemed like such a stupid thing to do. Somebody should have just called chicken and just gone somewhere else because they should have known they were both going to fail.
And that's So You Think You Can Dance because Dancing with the Stars is like one of the top shows in the country. So,
but even they are getting criticism for having a really lackluster season.
But it didn't matter. They still crushed them.
Well, Michael, what do you think? Big deal or big whoop?
Yeah, it's a big whoop because nobody's watching. So they made a bad mistake. Whoever made that decision should suffer for it, and they need to go back to the summer with their tail between their legs. But, of course, I'm the idiot who thought American Idol should remain a summer show, so what do I know?
At least you didn't say they should put Jay Leno on at 10. Our last story for this week's Big Deal or Big Whoop segment is about Neve Campbell. She is confirming that Wes Craven will join Scream 4. She also is confirming that she has signed on, despite not having seen a script yet. She says, "I'm pretty sure at this stage that Wes Craven is back on board to direct, and Kevin Williamson is definitely writing it. So it's going to be great."
No, it's more like, "I can't find work, and I am excited that somebody wanted to put me in a movie."
Oh, I like Neve Campbell. I think she's done interesting stuff.
I think that she can't act, and she's nothing but a giant twitch.
Wow.
She worked with Robert Altman. She developed that ballet dance.
I don't know how this happened. I think she is that untalented.
Wow. Michael, is this a big deal?
No, it's a big whoop. It's Scream 4.
Well, you both think it's a big whoop. We should actually keep track of how we're ruling on these stories because, you know, last week we said that whole Adam Lambert thing was a big whoop and it turned out to be a big deal this week.
I still think it's a big whoop. I think
we didn't know it was going to be a story. We just talked about its actual performance.
That's right.
Yeah.
Which we were still wrong about. But no, actually, we were right about because the performance did suck. We just didn't anticipate that it would be the big story that it became.
We'll wrap up today's episode with a little bit of Inside Baseball, our segment where we talk about the news stories that possibly only people in Hollywood care about. Variety today has a story about Lachlan Murdoch, who is Rupert Murdoch's, I think, eldest son. Turns out he's going to be purchasing The Hollywood Reporter and Billboard, or more appropriately, Nielsen Business Media. And this is, I guess, rumored and it's speculated and there are negotiations taking place, so he may not wind up with it. But right now it looks as if Nielsen Business Media is going to sell itself for around $70 million.
Oh, we should buy it.
I knew something was up with that company. They kept having jobs posted.
Well, yeah. You know, and I've said, I believe on this podcast in previous episodes that there are rumors circulating that The Hollywood Reporter as a paper entity, as a newspaper entity, will no longer publish the paper edition and will be online only starting sometime next year. So it will be interesting to see if he does wind up with it, whether those rumors are thrown to the wind and all bets are off.
It's an interesting story.
Yeah. Lachlan trying to make a name for himself outside the shadow of his father. I remember when he was sort of running the New York Post, not that I ever crossed paths with him while I was a freelance writer there, but you know, they're both name brands. What they're worth in this day and age, $70 million doesn't seem like that much. Just off the top of my head, I'm not quite sure what physical assets they're getting for that $70 million. I assume it's not just the, you know, the rights to the magazines.
No, but, I mean, Nielsen Business Media is they have a number of different publications.
Yeah, but they also might have, you know, physical properties as well. You know, they might own buildings and stuff. So there might be more than that. They might own plants, who knows?
Well, but, they throw Show West and Show East each year.
Right, exactly. So $70 million doesn't seem like a fairly reasonable price for all those. I mean, Billboard's a name brand. Hollywood Reporter's a name brand, but I don't know. It's a good time to buy magazines, I guess, if you're going to buy low. They should be at rock bottom prices.
I think it's an interesting choice for him that he chose he chose a media company. If he's going to go against his father, and you know he had a lot of trouble when he was at News Corp. He's going to go against his father, and now he's purchasing magazines where he could write about his father's company. I find fascinating.
That's very true. I didn't think of it that way. He was News Corp's former deputy chief operating officer, and he left News Corp in 2005, moving back to Australia, and he started working on some of his own business activities. Of course, Rupert Murdoch has always said he hopes his son returns to News Corp. Nielsen Business Media includes such publications as Backstage, Brand Week, Editor and Publisher, Billboard, as mentioned, Ad Week, Media Week, and The Hollywood Reporter. So, and that's just their publications. That has nothing to do with their events and some of the other market research work that they do. Last week, Lachlan acquired 50% of the Daily Mail in the UK and General Trust's Australian radio assets for a sum believed to be in the region of about $96 million. And all of this was being reported in the Financial Times originally.
It's good to see a scrappy kid scrape together a couple hundred million dollars and make some, try to build a business for himself.
A scrappy kid.
On that note, that brings us to the end of this week's show. Of course, you can subscribe to our podcast on iTunes or on our website, which is at showbizsandbox.com. Now, our website is also where you'll find links to all of the stories we discussed on today's episode. You should look them up in the show notes for episode 31. Our website is also where you'll find links to all of our social networking accounts, including Facebook, where we have a fan page, I guess it is. I don't know what.
Yeah, it's a fan page.
It's a page. But we've actually been a lot more active there, so please feel free to join in the conversation. A link to our Twitter account, at ShowbizSandbox, is also there. If you want to write to us and comment on any of the stories or send us any feedback, you can do so. dirt@showbizsandbox.com is the email address to send your thoughts and missives to. That's dirt@showbizsandbox.com. We will be reading some of the listener emails on future episodes. We will also be playing some of our listener voicemails. You can leave us a voicemail. 888-567-SAND is the number to call. That's 888-567-7263. Now, Michael, you can be found on michaelgiltz.com. Of course, you write for the New York Daily News and Huffington Post and The Advocate and any one of a number of publications. Anything we should be looking out for in particular?
No, just regularly working.
Okay. Also, you're on Twitter. Michael Giltz is the username to look up. Karen, you're on Twitter. KWoody3939, I believe.
That's right.
Yep, that's the username to look up. You also can be found KarenWoodwardOnline.com.
That's right.
I forgot. I am doing a weekly radio show now on community radio that's available on iTunes. If you go to michaelgiltz.com, you can find a link. I have a link to Showbiz and to this. It's like a 2-hour, 3-hour show every week built around a theme. Like New Year's Eve, I'll do a show built around drinking. I'll play all songs about drinking.
So it's like Bob Dylan's Theme Time Radio Hour.
Well, exactly. It's more like Northern Exposure. It's more inspired by the DJ of Northern Exposure. And I was making themed, audio cassettes long before Bob Dylan did his radio show. But yes, absolutely. He did a great show. I think he sort of put it on hiatus or stopped it for a while. But I throw in facts and read poetry and tell stories and play lots of music from every possible genre. So I've been having a lot of fun with that.
It's once a week.
Every Thursday night from 1 a.m. to 3 a.m. Eastern Standard Time. You can stream it online at weft.org. But you can find all the links on michaelgiltz.com. But then I put it up as a podcast.
I can be found on Twitter. @Sperling is the username to look up. Or on celluloidjunkie.com. Until next week, play nice.